Thank you for the very nice introduction. So I'm super happy to talk here today because so this is home for me in two senses. So first of all, I am part of a Max Planck Institute, just another one. But also I'm the speaker of the Open Science Initiative at the University of Leipzig, so I'm super happy to see something similar happening here at the MPI. So after Corinna gave that amazing, like, broader introduction, also highlighting political aspects, we are going to get into the more technical side of things by talking about pre-registration and registered reports. And maybe to start with like a central observation, and I've shamelessly stolen that from Chris Chambers, it's not mine. So which part of a research study do you believe should be beyond your control as a scientist? So you can choose your research topic, you can like generate your theory, your hypotheses, you can come up with the best method to test it, but the results should be outside of your control because that is what you want to learn from your study. But then which part of your research study is actually most important for advancing your career? Well, it's the results. And so there's an obvious tension here that can also be reframed as some sort of conflict of interest with yourself. So on the one hand, I assume we as scientists, and I really believe that, most of us are motivated by the fact that we want to find out what's true, because otherwise it would be a horrible occupational choice because it's not well paid and so on, and it's a lot of insecurity. So I assume most of us are motivated by some intrinsic motivation. But at the same time as human beings, we also have some interest in either furthering or maintaining our careers, or at least not be unemployed. And so in the current incentive structure, this currently requires publications, preferably in prestigious outlets, and so there's an obvious tension there. So what happens if these two motives collide? So what do we do if planned procedures don't give us those shiny, pristine results that we need to get published in those very good outlets? So there are different ways to solve this. And one way in which this has been tackled in the past and about which Felix Schönbrod is going to talk about a bit more is that idea of researcher degrees of freedoms. So there are all these little hacks you can do when conducting a study, like including multiple outcome measures and just kind of reporting the one that works, or like collecting more participants if you see a promising trend in the data, but it's not quite significant yet. Maybe if you do an experiment, you can control for gender effects. You kind of don't have to identify the real effect, but you can do that. You might also drop a condition that probably wasn't meant to be like serious part of the experiment. Maybe you just wanted to test something. And of course, you can combine all of the above. And so those are like, I think they used to be, at least in some parts of psychology, like canonical tricks of the trade. So kind of everybody was doing that. And then in 2011, there was that paper called False Positive Psychology. And so kind of if there's nothing going on in your data and if you stick to the like conventional alpha threshold, you should find something in 5% of the cases. But now if you're willing to use these degrees of freedom, you essentially double these numbers, so you have a much better chance of finding something in noise. And now, of course, the scary part is when you are willing to combine multiple of these things, you can get a false positive rate, and that's like just their estimate in their simulations, but you can get up to 100%. So that was, I think 2011 was an oh shit moment for many psychologists who read that paper. So the essential insight is that with a creative approach, anything can become significant. And so in the afternoon, I think Felix Schönbrod is actually going to teach you how to do that. And there are many different terms for this, for example, p-hacking. Then there's also been that broader notion of questionable research practices, QRPs. Andrew Gelman has used that a bit more metaphorical picture of the garden of forking paths. And one term that I really like that Talia Coney is using a lot is procedural overfitting, because you're overfitting your data, but it's part of the process. So it's not just your statistical model, it's what you do yourself. And what I find super important to highlight about this, and this is also why this was an oh shit moment for many people, is that this does not require any bad actors. So if you do a study and you had a certain plan in your head, and then the results don't turn out the right way, but maybe your analysis is not the best one and so on. So it's very human to afterwards come up for good decisions to justify certain decisions. So maybe an analysis gives you nicer results, and you will be very, very good at generating a justification for sticking with that analysis. And that is very human. So there's an obligatory quote included in, I think, 50% of all open science talks. And that is the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool. So this is not about people necessarily intentionally gaming the system, but more that idea that it's very, very easy actually to fool yourself. And that's where that idea of pre-registration comes into play. So pre-registration is actually super simple. So it's just a timestamp document in which you describe the details of the planned study. And that's essentially it. So right now it doesn't mean anything else. And this has a lot of benefits. So first of all, just from a general perspective of transparency, you get a lot more transparency about the research process, because normally you don't know what researchers were planning, and this makes it transparent and spells it all out. And the main benefit for the scientific community is that it allows readers to clearly distinguish between things that you plan to do and things that you came up with afterwards. So it's not necessarily supposed to mean, oh, you have to do exactly what you wrote in your pre-registration. Actually, later we are going to see that never happens. But it makes it transparent what was your plan and what happened afterwards, and you can just assess any discrepancy. And so this essentially makes it harder to fool yourself. So I know people who do like internal pre-registrations, in particular those who are like early adopters who are like, oh, can I pre-register secondary data analysis? Well, I don't know, but I want to actually hold myself accountable. So they wrote down what they were going to do, and they were surprised when they came back later on and were like, oh no, what were we thinking? You know, everything looks so different. So it protects yourself from fooling yourself, but of course it also prevents you from fooling others. So if you're planning to do a pre-registration, or maybe who of you has pre-registered something before? Raise your hands. Okay, that's actually already quite a few people. So you may already know more about the details. So there's a lot of questions that one can ask oneself. So where do I pre-register? What do I need to put into the pre-registration? That's a pretty tough question. And what about other types of research? Like I'm doing mainly a secondary data analysis. How does pre-registration fit into my workflow? Or what do I do when I want to explore the data? Or what about other types of research, such as modeling or simulation work that normally looks very different from the typical experimental setup? So first of all, where can I pre-register my study? So in principle, you can do that anywhere where you can timestamp a document, which is essentially almost everywhere on the internet. But of course, that would result in a huge mess. So there are some all-purpose pre-registration registries about which I'm going to talk. But it's also, I think, important to keep in mind that there are also specialized registries. So for example, I'm working with sociologists, and they use the RCT registry by the American Economic Association. And if anybody of you is doing clinical work, there are, of course, specific clinical trial registries, which will also come up later in this talk because they have a much longer tradition and might give us some insights about how well pre-registration can work or not. For the all-purpose pre-registration registries, the two most popular ones, at least within psychology, and maybe two particularly accessible ones, are As Predicted and the Open Science Framework. So As Predicted is actually super straightforward. If you pre-register there, you will get 9 short questions. You have a limited amount of space to answer them. And then all participating authors have to approve that. So there's some sort of protection that like your grad student who's actually running this study doesn't cause a huge mess, because all authors involved give their sign of approval. And the pre-registration on As Predicted can actually stay private until forever, ever. So nothing happens unless you explicitly say this document should become public. You can also generate like a view-only link for the peer review process. So the Open Science Framework works a bit different. First of all, it offers you a large number of different templates. For example, there you can find a template for secondary data pre-registration that will ask you specific questions that wouldn't apply if you ran your own study and collected the data yourself. The OSF also makes sure that all participating authors approve, but they have a bit of a different, they have an opt-out system. So your co-authors will get an email, hey, you got 48 hours. And after those 48 hours, it will be pre-registered, which I think works a bit better, just because you have that pressure of 48 hours, while this approach can mean that if the senior author doesn't care too much, then it could take forever until it gets approved. And on the Open Science Framework, the pre-registration can only be kept private for up to 4 years, and after that, the embargo is automatically lifted, and everything goes online. And so I think there's a huge advantage to that, because people are already kind of suspecting that people are gaming as predicted by essentially pre-registering the same study over and over again, just with slight tweaks, and then you collect data once and see which one gives you the best result. So I think we don't know whether that happens. The people who do as predicted, who are actually the people behind the false positive psychology paper, they say they are implementing some checks to ensure that the pre-registrations can't be too similar and so on. But we don't know how well that works, and of course they can't tell us their secret algorithm to check that, because then it wouldn't work anymore. So I think there are good reasons to stick with the Open Science Framework, where you have that guarantee that after 4 years everything becomes public. And it also means that, I think that should happen soon, that the first pre-registration embargoes get lifted. So that will probably be an interesting moment to see what gets posted online suddenly. You can still, of course, withdraw your pre-registration. So if you run out of funding or can't run the study, you can declare that. That's no issue at all. You just need to be transparent about it. It will leave metadata. It will leave the title, so people will see, oh, there was a pre-registration about this topic. And you can add a justification and just explain why you didn't pursue that study. So what type of information should get into a pre-registration? And that's a tough question. Right now, and that's just the descriptive norm, if you look at pre-registration, it's surprising because people kind of just put in there what they want to write. And so I have seen papers claiming to be pre-registered, but it's just like, we are going to run a study on implicit bias. And that's it. So right now, the descriptive norm is just people put in there what they want to, so you also get very elaborate pre-registrations, but you also just get like a single sentence, oh, we are doing a study on this or that. And the more prescriptive norm would be, of course, if our issuer researcher degrees of freedom, you want to ensure that all the researcher degrees of freedom are controlled in some way. So that would include fixed decisions, so for example, which outcome measure are you going to use, how are you going to calculate that outcome measure, but also more flexible decision rules, because actually many things you can't know ahead of time. So you might add a certain rule that if something goes wrong, you're going to act that way. If something else goes wrong, then you're going to do something else, and so on. Because there's a lot of flexibility in how you run analyses, ideally there should be like an explanation of the statistical models. If that's a randomized control experiment and you're really just doing a t-test, that will be very short. If your models are more sophisticated than that, it might actually make sense to already upload the analysis script, which is like the most detailed description of your statistical models that is possible. And that might again also include data-dependent decision rules. So sometimes people are concerned that, oh, I don't know what the outcome distribution will look like, so I don't know how to best model it. And that's actually no big problem. If you know it ahead of time, you can think about that. Maybe write down different types of models you would run depending on the data. And if you don't think of that ahead of time, that's also no problem, because you can always explain afterwards why you had to go that way. And if it's a convincing explanation, people won't think that there's anything weird about it. And last but not least, I think a researcher degree of freedom that people tend to forget about is like, how are you going to interpret your results? So at least in psychology, we are very much stuck in that dichotomous thinking. So either we confirm our hypothesis by rejecting the null hypothesis, or we say, oh, we can't say anything. And of course, a pre-registration gives you the space to actually think about that a bit harder and think about what would be evidence that convinces you into accepting your hypothesis of an alternative hypothesis and so on. So that was the prescriptive take, and you see that this is a lot of things to think about. And realistically speaking, you won't be able to anticipate everything. Nobody does. So the pragmatic take is you should try to specify as much as you can ahead of time. What that will probably mean is that if you do this over and over again, your pre-registrations will become more complex and contain more information because you make that experience. Or even if you're just an experienced researcher, you know how many decisions are involved. And so they will probably become longer with time. And you might also notice that it's not super feasible to always spell everything out in a pre-registration. And so there are multiple labs that have moved on to just being more explicit about standard operating procedures. So for example, if in your line of research you always need a particular data processing pipeline, you could pre-register that once and refer to this in all following studies, or just have timestamp standard operating procedures. This is how we are currently dealing with this in our lab. And then you don't need to write this into every pre-registration over and over again. Just refer to your standard operating procedures. And my general piece of advice would be that you should simply, if you want to get started with this, use one of the established templates that make sure that you don't forget the most obvious things. So you will still later regret that you didn't pre-register some aspects of your study, but you're not going to miss anything obvious, like the sample size or how you're going to recruit participants. And the slides are all online, and so I've added some links that I consider helpful. Then another big debate we are currently having in the open science bubble in psychology is, well, what about other types of research? And so there have been some arguments about whether pre-registration is at all relevant for certain types of research. For example, I know that quite a few people who are more involved in cognitive modeling and so on say, like, oh, this doesn't work for us, this doesn't apply to our research. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that different types of research have to tackle with different types of biases and different issues. But that being said, pre-registration might still be useful for many situations. So I actually do know people who do cognitive modeling who still find it immensely helpful just for themselves, because it helps you to clarify ahead of time what you know about the planned study and what you don't know, which is actually a good thing to think about in general before you do a study, whether you pre-register it or not. Another aspect, of course, is full transparency. So if your analysis is going to be super exploratory, oh, I don't even know which statistical model to use, I have no idea what I'm doing here, if you spell it out, it's fully transparent. And for example, that might be helpful later on. It's also sending like a strong signal that you did not plan to reframe your exploratory story as confirmatory, which is happening quite frequently right now, I suspect. And so in general, so pre-registration has come up in that context of false positives and researcher degrees of freedoms and so on. But I do think there are some like more general benefits of integrating pre-registration into one's workflow. So first of all, it's a good tool for yourself to plan before you conduct the study. And of course, everybody is planning their studies, I assume. I'm not always sure. But people tend to miss certain parts. So there's that classical scenario of like a statistical advisor, and people come up, hey, I ran this study, now how do I analyze this? And then the first question is, well, what's your research question? And I'm interested in, like, how does this relate to that, and so on. And so if you think about that ahead of time, you might actually be able to design a better study because you have to clarify a lot of questions. Having a pre-registration is also kind of handy if the reviewers ask you for a justification for certain decisions. Why did you do that? Like, nobody else does that, that looks fishy. But you can say, oh, this is actually what I pre-registered. And maybe your pre-registration even includes a justification for why you use this analysis instead of the thing that everybody else does, which might be worse in some cases. And at least for some early career researchers in psychology, I've heard that that has been useful for them to avoid being pressured into getting a cleaner, generating a cleaner narrative. So that's also looping back to that bullied into bad science paper, that there's actually quite a few incidents in psychology where researchers got pressured by the editors and the reviewers to kind of like run some additional analyses and maybe then reframe the introduction, so basically p-hacking their data, and then like harking, so changing the hypotheses afterwards. And having that pre-illustration is just something you can point to as a researcher if you don't want to get into that situation of pressure. But then you might wonder, well, but if the editors and reviewers want me to do that, well, maybe they are not interested in my study if they can't do that anymore because I got a pre-registration. And so there's obviously some friction involved in this whole process of pre-registration. And that is, the pre-registration does not mean that your results will be published. That's just a fact. So it, if you want to get that paper out there, there might still be pressures to beautify the results. And so right now in certain parts of psychology, it has been sort of, it has become sort of normative to pre-register, at least if you want to publish in certain prestigious outlets, such as Psychological Science. And so there are some like intentional or unintentional tricks of the trade that people use to kind of get past of that restrictive character of pre-registration. And so two things we have observed now are like excessively vague pre-registrations that actually don't restrict researcher degrees of freedom at all, but also just undisclosed deviations. So you say something in your pre-registration, you do something else in the published article, and it's disclosed nowhere. So, and when I gave this talk like a year ago, or similar talk, I couldn't point to anything. It was just like, this is what we are observing. But meta science is moving ahead fast, so now we actually got sources we can point to. So Feldkamp et al. Actually took a look at pre-registrations and how detailed they were, and whether they were able to actually control the most obvious researcher degrees of freedom. And they looked at one, like a random sample of 100 pre-registration forms, and they did find a lot of unrestricted researcher degrees of freedoms. But in the newer version of this preprint, actually, they are comparing two different types of pre-registration. And it also becomes clear that using a pre-registration form that gives more detailed instructions and has a particular workflow for filling it out, and is actually independently reviewed for completeness, that makes quite the difference. So yes, people do overly vague pre-registrations, but we know that giving them a clearer guideline or a clearer template reduces that issue. While at the same time, and this is now purely anecdotally, is that early career researchers have been instructed to intentionally leave some leeway. So essentially keep the pre-registration as vague as possible, because we know the study is not going to work otherwise. So I think it's, so there's a mix in there of like issues you can actually fix by giving people some more support, but of course still other motivations going on in the background. As for undisclosed deviations, there is a very, very recent preprint that compared 38 pre-registrations with the final article and looked at deviations. And so they found deviations from the plan in all of those studies. And as I said before, that's actually not a problem. So you can't anticipate everything that's going to happen. And so sometimes things go wrong and so on, and that's no problem at all. But now the big problem is, only one of these studies actually disclosed all deviations, which means that in all of the other studies, there were undisclosed deviations. And of course, these undisclosed deviations, they undermine the whole idea of increased transparency. You might even say it makes it even worse, because people will assume, oh, this is pre-registered, this is not like cherry-picked, but then there is that whole ton of deviations that you don't know about. And so, I don't know whether this came as a surprise to people in 2019. We could have kind of expected that just from looking at clinical trials. So there's a much longer like tradition of pre-registration or just like clinical trial registration. And essentially what we are observing there is that so people are forced to register their trials, and so they do that. But then when they actually report their trials, they report something else. So what I found quite impressive, so Ben Goldacker and colleagues, they checked 67 clinical trials, and 354 outcomes went unreported that were registered as the primary outcome, but also 357 outcomes were silently added without any explanation where they suddenly came from. So there was a huge mismatch between the trial registrations and the actual outcomes. So what does that all mean for pre-registration and for that shiny new pre-registration badge you can get? So it essentially, right now, what it signals is there exists some documents somewhere that specifies some details of the planned study, maybe not all of them, maybe a lot. And those details might or might not get implemented in the final studies, and the reader might or might not be able to find out the deviations. And so that maybe sounds a bit negative, and I think I'm going to give a talk why pre-registration is great. So I'd like to highlight that even if that seems kind of problematic, I think it's just like symptomatic of our research culture currently, that people still, even if you have this added accountability, you still feel pressured into twisting things in a certain way. And of course, if there is a pre-registration, well, at least you can go back and compare that pre-registration with the published article. And maybe even if it's not fully transparent in the paper, you can double check. So it certainly does make a difference in comparison to unregistered studies, but it's far from perfect. And so that's where the whole idea of registered reports comes into play. And I'm not saying that they are perfect, but they do address some of these central issues. So first of all, major registered reports remove one of the major incentives to beautify results. And then they ensure that the pre-registration and the published article actually match with deviations clearly marked. And so how does that work? So Corinna already mentioned it. So the idea behind a registered report is that you develop an idea, you design the study, you write an introduction, the method section, and that plan is being peer reviewed. And so there might be a few iterations of revisions and so on, because reviewers can still like say, oh, your design sucks, why don't you do this or that way? But if reviewers are happy, then you get something called in principle acceptance. So that is a guarantee that the article will get published at the journal no matter what the results. And if you have that in principle acceptance, you move on, you collect and analyze the data, you write the report. There is stage two peer review, in which in theory your article shouldn't be able to get rejected anymore. And I'm saying in theory because it sometimes indeed happens that even though there is no incentive to create a certain narrative, sometimes researchers still try to deviate from their own plan and kind of twist things in a different way. So there's a second round of peer review just to ensure that you are actually reporting what you intended to report and that all exploratory analyses are clearly marked as such, and that it's just fully transparent what you planned ahead of time and what came afterwards. And then the report gets published. And so actually, those registered reports have a lot of like benefits that have nothing to do with controlling researcher degrees of freedoms. So one thing is that peer review happens when it's actually still useful. So you might know those commentaries when you have like a peer reviewer telling you, oh yeah, that's all like fine and dandy, but actually you should have run a completely different study. And then what do you do? Like, do you go back? Like, do you run a new study? It would have been much more useful to know that ahead of time. And so pre-registered reports allow you to actually change the design in response to reviewers' feedback. And of course, it's like, it's just psychologically different to run a study when you already know that no matter what the outcome, you will be able to publish this. And it's also like a very nice feeling to just like look at the results then in the end, because it's more like opening a Christmas present, but that Christmas present does not decide whether or not you will be able to find a job. So with all these amazing benefits, the question arises, where can I do this thing? Because it's a different publication format, so it's bound to certain journals. And what I wrote here is actually not up to date anymore. Chris Chambers just tweeted to me yesterday. So there are 194 journals that have implemented registered reports. as either a regular submission option or just as part of a special issue. So there's actually already quite a large number of outlets. There's also that thing that if your favorite journal does not offer registered reports, but you're really interested in it, there's always the possibility to pitch the idea to the journal. That's actually, I think, how most of those journals got involved. So there's actually materials to do exactly that on the Open Science Framework page for registered reports. And maybe there's again that question, well, to which types of research does this apply? And I think initially it was, again, like a narrow focus on experimental studies. But there are now additional forms of registered reports. So for example, of course, registered replication reports, but also secondary data analysis registered reports, which are being offered at the new APS journal AMPS, where you have to prove that you have not accessed the data before you analyzed it. Before you do the pre-registration and the registered report. And I think there's also at least one journal offering exploratory registered reports where you just describe how you're going to explore the data. So actually, Chris Chambers is a very active person and always coming up with new things. So the next level that they are currently working on taking registered reports to is combining registered reports with funding. So the idea is that you basically submit the proposal to the journal and the funder at the same time. And if both accept you, you do get in principle acceptance for the article, and you also get funding to actually run the study, which has a lot of benefits, the usual benefits of registered reports. But additionally for funders, this is just added security that whatever they are funding there will get out eventually. So the question is, if we start doing registered reports, what will our results look like? What can we expect? And we can expect one thing, which is way more null findings. And so there's the first, like, so there have been two empirical analyses of that. There's always a certain lag because it takes time until we see enough registered reports being published. And so what you can see here in this one analysis is that the number of supported hypotheses in not registered reports is at 95% or 96%. That's really good. And in registered reports, it doesn't look quite that good. So it's below 50% actually. And it also, I think, reflects Chris Chambers' experience that most things don't actually work, even if they sounded like a very good idea when the registered report got accepted. And so this, I think, already leads to some concerns that people have about both pre-registration and registered reports. And so there's that idea that this will make articles messy and boring, and the whole literature will be littered with negative findings. And so for the messy part, I probably agree, because often that's just like how reality is. So it's a bit messy. You have a plan of what you want to do, and then you see that that doesn't work, and then you don't know whether your plan was the better plan, or maybe there you should have done another plan, and so on. And so that's just like, that's the way data are. But there's, of course, a real challenge in there, and that is balancing readability and accessibility and transparency. So you can just dump all your data on the reader, and that's fully transparent, but of course the reader won't be able to get anything out of it or to make sense out of it. It's also maybe a bit easier to tackle these challenges these days, just because space is no longer limited to the few pages you get in the journal. So I would encourage everyone who's kind of struggling with that to use online supplements, or maybe take a look at what my friend and co-blogger Ruben Aslan is doing, because he does these amazing, fully reproducible websites where he reports all robustness checks and so on. So there are, I think, cool new ways to report results in a manner that is both readable and accessible, but also transparent. And as for the boring aspect, probably not. So there's that weird notion that with registered reports, people would do the most boring study possible, where you're guaranteed to find a significant effect, which kind of is interesting in itself because it implies that it was kind of like the whole point of research was finding a significant effect supporting your hypothesis. And then you would just move on and probably do a registered report with the Stroop effect. I don't think that this will happen in practice, simply because reviewers are still reviewers, and they will still judge your study on multiple dimensions, such as, is this actually informative? Is this relevant? And does this further our theories and so on? And apart from that, of course, registered reports, so normally reviewers will insist on a decent sample size, so it also gives you an incentive to design a study that's going to be interesting regardless of the results, which I think would be the ideal state if your study would be interesting no matter whether the outcome was significant or not, in most, maybe not in all cases. There's that other concern that pre-registration will devalue exploratory research. And I'm not quite sure where this comes from. I've heard it actually multiple times. And I would say it's actually quite the opposite, because what's happening right now is, at least in psychology, we don't see much explicitly exploratory research, and people certainly never use the right statistical tools. And what people are basically doing is they are running rather exploratory studies and then selling them as confirmatory afterwards. And I think this is something we need to get rid of just for scientific reasons. And it's important to keep in mind that good exploration is far from trivial. So if anybody of you is doing actually exploratory work or working more with machine learning, you know that there are certain precautions you have to take. You can't just run 500 t-tests and then report the one that is significant. So I think making it, like drawing a clearer line between confirmation and exploration, will also force us to think harder about how we can do good exploration. And so I think what people who say that probably want to kind of have their cake and eat it too. So do highly exploratory research, but then apply the evidence standards from confirmatory research. And there's also other notions that pre-registration would be unnecessary because we actually kind of have that. For example, in grant applications, conference talks, dissertation proposals, and so on, you already know what people are working on. But it's important to keep in mind that this is, first of all, not accessible to most people, like who reads your grant proposal. And the level of detail is quite specific. I mean, maybe some of you have like decision rules for sample size and data collection termination in their grant proposal, but that's not the norm. I've also learned from Chris Chambers that people write grant proposals for research they have already conducted, which I found very surprising, but seems to be very common in some fields of research. And last but not least, it seems a very optimistic take on the match between proposals versus the study you actually conduct. So I don't think that these other outlets are sufficient controls of researcher degrees of freedoms. There is another point, and I think that's actually a very good point, is that actually we shouldn't have that many researcher degrees of freedom, because a strong theory already constrains what we are going to do with our data. And so that probably won't work for all researcher degrees of freedom, because your theory won't tell you the right sample size, and you need to have some additional conventions. But it certainly reduces the space of plausible or defensible hypothesis tests. And so I would say, yeah, good theories are absolutely necessary, and pre-registration, but also all the other open research practices, they are not sufficient to guarantee good research. And I'm going to skip that part. So more generally, there has been that notion, oh, but pre-registration does not solve all these other issues. And I totally agree. This is absolutely true. So pre-registration and registered reports are not going to solve all issues with empirical research. But they do have many plausible benefits. And I think they may be able to fix some very common problems. So I would just suggest that you give it a shot if you haven't tried yet. But I think also that the next speakers who are going to share your experience may also offer some words of encouragement. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.